Welcome to MIR Meets. I'm your host, Sydney Murray, and today we're speaking with the past international president of Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, and founder of PEARL, the new pandemic evaluation and readiness lab here at McGill, Dr. Joanne Liu. Dr. Liu's experience ranges from working as a specialist in pediatrics and rigorous fieldwork and management with Médecins Sans Frontières, to sitting on several Lancet commissions, including the Pandemic Readiness Implementation, Monitoring, and Evaluation, or PRIME Commission, and the CHH Lancet Commission on Conflict and Force Displacement and Promoting Resilience, Preparedness, Adaptation, and Response to Climate and Complex Crises. Recently, Dr. Liu is working with her newly founded McGill Lab, focusing on issues of health communication and studying and combating health misinformation and disinformation campaigns. Hi, Dr. Liu. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here and have you speak with the McGill International Review.
Thank you to have me.
We are just going to start off with kind of some brief personal questions. Along the lines of you working for MSF, what were some of the motivating factors along your career path, not necessarily career choices, but personal push factors that led you to eventually being the international president of Doctors Without Borders?
What was some of the push to lead me to the position of the international president at MSF? Is that correct?
Yeah, some of the personal motivating factors, things you might have encountered along the lines of your career.
I think it's difficult to answer. That was not, I would say, a plan ascension or a plan thing. It was more, I ended up having more responsibility into the field than I went from being a field doctor at a project level to become what we call a medical coordinator, to become a head of mission. And after that, I was offered to be in charge of operation in Paris for 3 years. Then I came back, and then after that, on all my mission, my field assignment were very much emergency, startup, assessment. And what became clear after a little while is that the movement of MSF was changing. I was getting concerned about the fact that we were spending a fair amount of money and energy on increasing our footprint almost only in the global north and not as much as in the global south where we have operation. And I was getting concerned that we were feeling a real imbalance in terms of our operation versus our supporting resources. And this was quite interesting because when you looked at it, MSF was created in 1971, and the people who volunteer with MSF started to get old. And so they wanted not to go to the field anymore, but they wanted more stable job in the headquarters.
Okay.
And so it was somehow, I would say, following this evolution. The reality is we always said, and this is not true anymore, it doesn't hold true anymore, but in the past, you would get into the humanitarian aid sector, and then the first thing people will tell you it's that it is not a profession. This is something that you do on the side, but you don't make it a profession, you don't make it a career. And because it was like high turnover, this is why for the longest time, the way that we were being compensated were very minimal. Yeah. For example, the first year you go on the field with MSF, you call it the year of the desert, which means that you get a little stipend and that's about it. And your expenses are covered in doing your field assignment. But just to say that this whole thing has changed over the last decades, and then all of a sudden you have the feeling that you're spending more times in nurturing the supportive element of MSF than the operation of MSF. And so when I decided to go and run for the international presidency was to make sure that we were keeping squarely central our operation, that it was the priority, and that we are doubling down on the quality of care that we were offering in the field, that we were not giving second-rate type of care, but we were aiming and working for the best high-tech care that we could deliver with the means that we had, and we would advocate for that as well.
Do you think nowadays, with the thought process that you can actually turn working into an organization like MSF into a career path, has bettered the level of care that you provide with a larger commitment of your members?
I'm not sure that the commitment is the same. I think that the commitment that we had in the past was a different commitment, because people, this is a word that we don't use anymore nowadays, but this was a sense of vocation. Okay. There was a sense of a call. People were doing it because they were profoundly believing in the social mission of Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. Mm-hmm. And they were not looking for secondary gain. They were not looking for fame. They were not looking for a career path. They had the basic desire to go and give a hand somewhere. And then today, it's being taxed of all sorts of things, of being neocolonial, not being respecting the local, possibly authority or beliefs and all that. And of course, we were not perfect. But I think that sort of what I call engagement in French, which is the commitment, the deep commitment, mm-hmm. might be different today, because we never thought about making a career. We just did it.
And is that why, potentially for you, I know as part of your bio on the Pearl website, it says that you're still a practicing physician. Is that why you kept up your practicing physician part of your life? Because you knew that this was something that you always wanted to do, and it was just almost the side thing that you were doing, working for MSF?
Yeah, I always kept my clinical practice throughout, and I make a huge effort to do that. I'm now winding down on this aspect, but for the longest time I did that because, I think that when you have a direct connection with a patient, mm-hmm. You keep their interests and their concern mm-hmm. in the center of what you're doing. And it's very humbling to face patients on a regular basis, because what you may think is their concern is often not their concern. And then you realize that you possibly are not have the right reading. Yeah. I find that being in a regular contact with patients can keep you humble as a caretaker, because it's complex. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Each patient is unique, and each healing process is unique.
Would you say that this patient-to-patient interaction that you had drove some of your goals when you were president of MSF, or it kind of changed the way you looked at problems when you approached them?
At the very least, I think it changed the way I was looking at them, because it's something to do operation for patient in an abstract way. Mm-hmm. But it's a different thing when you do operation with name of patient in your head, and you say, oh, I'm doing that because Mohammed didn't pull through last time, mm-hmm. or because Animata got worse and we can do better, so we have to improve that part. So it gave a sort of a more personalized driven steam to things. Anyway, it was my way of doing it. I don't think it's the best way. I don't think it's a unique way, but it was my way.
And just kind of building off of your way of doing things, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you specialized in pediatrics, correct?
Right.
Would you say that when you were working with children's health, it was an interesting indicator for how a healthcare system operated? Or how did working with children and not necessarily with adults change the way you kind of looked at how a healthcare system functioned?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I ever looked at it this way. I actually, the reason why I went into pediatrics is the fact that when I did my training mm-hmm. as a medical student, actually, initially, I wanted to be a surgeon. Oh. And I was really hung up to be a surgeon because yeah. I had read book of people working with MSF, being a surgeon at the mm-hmm. front line, saving lives, and I thought it was the hardest thing on earth to be. Yeah. And I did my rotation in surgery, and I profoundly hated it.
Okay.
Because it was like macho, there was almost no women in the field, and yeah. I just figured out I cannot envision myself being for 5 to 10 years mm-hmm. as a resident and then a fellow going through that. I was very eager to go to the field quickly enough. And then what was clear to me is the patient that I liked the most were the children, because children are the most, I would say, authentic patient you may have when they are sick, they stop playing, they stop eating. And when they're doing better, they start eating again and they start to play again. And there's no sort of game about it. They have this sort of very authentic way of telling you what they have. And then you need to learn to read that. But I like that sort of a very, I would say, raw truth about human being.
So by working with children, it almost got you down to the level of just interacting one-on-one with people and allowing you to do your job better, but also have those more genuine human connections through your work.
Yes, I guess you can say it this way. Yes, I just think that kids are the best patient. I think they're fun to work with. It just, I just remember being awakened in the middle of the night, and then you get into the room and you go, hello, and it's all happy. And then you just say, well, how can I not be happy? And that's it. And of course they are, you know, they were having this kind of, because there were a lot of asthma in the past, and the medicine we're giving were really still very much exciting the children. So they get very, very excited. But children are like the sort of very, very, very human patient that you can have. They don't play a game. It's just what you see is what it is.
So it's always kind of very surface. I don't want to say surface level because it's not, but it's very honest, and you know what you're going to see. And from that, it brings you joy yourself.
Well, it's just that, and then, but the thing is, even if there's sometime a child might not articulate what is going through, the way the child behaves, you know that something is wrong. And so you can figure it out. And so you still haven't socialized yourself to a point of covering up or changing things, not yet when you're fairly small. I think teenager time is a bit a different thing.
Yeah.
But preteen time, they don't have that yet. Not as much anyway.
I think it's incredible, at least personally, to learn that you started off as a like how much you love children as a pediatric doctor. Because I think sometimes we build these people up in our head, especially with your job title from 20 until 2019 as this International President of Doctors Without Borders. It's lovely to hear about how much you love working with children. I'd love to move on to the Prime Commission. And any questions you can't answer, if you can't, just tell me no. I am more than willing to hear that. But I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit of kind of what was talked about at the commission, especially now that we're about 6 years out from COVID, if there have been any changes to how pandemic preparedness is kind of looked at now, or how governments are approaching pandemics, just maybe some main themes or key takeaways that you got from the commission.
So the Prime Commission, which is, I can't remember what the acronym is standing again for, but it's about preparation for the next pandemic. Its approach initially, when we were set up as a commission for the Lancet, was to just say, hey guys, it is really clear that whatever we had as indicator of preparedness for COVID-19, somehow there were some blind spots, because some of the countries who ranked the highest, like the US, like UK, didn't fare well. And didn't do that great. And so there must be something else about that. And so can you come with a new set of indicators? And so initially we were very much on that path, you know, what could be the indicator, blah, 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 of preparedness. And then what we did is we went into, I think it's 21 countries where we did assessment, and it was a qualitative approach to our research. And then try to figure it out, what is preparedness, what we think is preparedness, interview people from government level, but for community level. And then what emerged very quickly is the fact that there are some groups that are somehow left out or sidelined from some vulnerable groups. And so what we end up looking into is what are those systemic vulnerabilities that we have? And I would say, like, in a nutshell, is the fact that if you were to fancy to be prepared for the next big one, like Michael Sturholm would say, you would you will make sure that, yes, that you have a system preparedness, but you have a community preparedness, what I call people preparedness. And that people preparedness include everybody, not only the wealthy one, not only the middle ground people, but as well the low income people, the people who are marginalized. Because if those people are not protected as well, they will always weaken your overall response.
Okay.
And they will always somehow create some step back in the overall response. And so that's what we are looking at in those, in terms of those, what we call systemic vulnerabilities. And it's not in a way to de-responsibilize country, because sometimes when we say, well, it's a systemic issue, then people just gave up.
Yeah.
And the idea is more, no, if you want to fare better next time, is you absolutely need to address those different blind spots about few or different vulnerable, marginalized communities to make sure that everybody is on board.
This may sound like a rather naive question, but coming from a Generation Z where social media is so prevalent in almost every corner of a lot of people's lives, do you think there's a way that it could be incorporated to discuss pandemic preparedness, healthcare awareness, or just along the lines of reaching populations that don't necessarily see healthcare in these, for example, more global North countries that should have fared better, and using it to kind of talk more about different diseases that are on the rise without necessarily causing panic?
That's an interesting question. I think that it creates so many other sub questions. But
yeah.
I think one of the mistakes, because I've did a fair amount of media during the COVID-19, and one of the posture that I always sort of said, I don't think it's really wise, was the fact that some of our political public speaker on COVID-19 were basically addressing people in a very assertive way in times of very little known facts. In very uncertain times. I think there's a way to communicate. People call it risk communication. I don't really like that term. But basically, I think that people are much smarter than people are somehow thinking or acknowledging or considering. I believe that if you were to speak to people, even in time of uncertainties, and you were to tell them, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, and this is what we would like to know, in a very honest way, I think that most of the people would be able to take that. Because what people were very, very resentful is to being told something, and then 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 3 months down the road, to go at 180 degrees, and not warning them that things will change, that it was an evolving situation, that we were building the evidence as we were going along, and so therefore the guidance will change. Like for example, I think that the fact that we hold back so much on acknowledging precisely that it was aerosols and not only droplets, and so therefore we needed to protect people, and the reality is we didn't have enough protection for everybody, and then initially that we have decided, because this is our last line of defense, to make sure that all people working in healthcare situation or in caring situation or in essential job, like in a drugstore or serving people food somewhere in a market, would be protected. I think people will have understand that, and they will do everything to provide you this protection afterwards. But the fact that we, like in, I don't know if you were in Quebec back then, but it was like pretty crazy that how much we pushed back on this. But not only that, once the evidence was that, we didn't even call a mask, but we call it a protège visage, I think it was. So we even re-Christian the word, because we don't want to say we were wrong. That for me is, of course, you create mistrust. And then people don't like uncertainties. but they can live with it if you inform them genuinely and authentically. But if they think that you are somehow lying or that you have a separate agenda behind, this is where distrust and mistrust is really building. And so, all this to say that I think that we can speak differently. Mm-hmm. We are actually in my lab right now, McGill. This is one of the key things that we are addressing. Mm-hmm. The information flow, the disinformation, the misinformation, and how to prepare better. This is what I call people preparedness. In its largest definition, not only in terms of technically speaking of protecting them or giving them the right public health guidance, but as well in terms of information.
How do you think, for example, the information pipeline today, when we're looking at different ways a pandemic can evolve? I know Canada in November lost its measles elimination status. Do you think that there should be some sort of information pipeline going back to the diseases that have, for example, already been eradicated to further just discuss in a very open, honest manner about what those diseases are and how, for example, vaccinations could play, how vaccinations may have some risks, kind of just going right back to the root of health education?
Well, I think there is some of that. But what is quite interesting is the fact that the people who should communicate on those topics are not. They're not occupying the space. And then what is interesting is there were like a study recently, and I think like 50% of the Canadians are looking into their medical information or quest or question through the website. Mm-hmm. But the reality, when they go and look for information, is the sources can be very, very diverse. My understanding, and this is what we're going to study further, but basically there are some of those governmental healthcare website that give you the information. And there's other people who are speaking about a health issue and may have or may not have as much of a background on the topic. Lots of influencers are talking about it, and lots of them are using as well some very, giving advice that are, I don't want to say if they're good or not good, but they are anyway not traditional type of advice. Mm-hmm. And so it's there. The curiosity is there. The want for more information is there. But if you don't occupy the space with the information and the facts, and it's being taken over by people who has taken the space, that doesn't have necessarily the background, the competences, the training for that, then you have different sort of things mm-hmm. accessible on the web. And I think that we need to do much, much better if we want to, how can I say, to inform the general population, to occupy a space in official website, but as well in less official way through podcasts, through different, stream of information.
Because I'll say personally, I know at the beginning of this year, because health communication for me has been kind of a niche interest, I went onto Instagram and I was like, well, is there a Canada Health website? Is there an Ontario Health website? Is there a Quebec Health website or Instagram page? And I couldn't find them. So I couldn't find some sort of Canadian kind of communication to Gen Z. And I thought that was a very interesting hole, because a lot of misinformation in itself starts on social media. And it's along the lines of, I've also had some friends who have told me some things and I'm like, well, where are you getting that information? They're getting the information off the platform that they're on. Right. So it's the lack of being where the curiosity is, as you said, that almost leads to the misinformation itself.
So if you are interested in your niche, come and join us.
We
are developing that exactly. And then we want to understand more. And I don't think that I don't want to blame people who are looking for information. We are the one to blame that we are not giving them the opportunity to have an accessible information for them. And so we need to work on that.
I 100% agree with you. And I think it's very interesting to have discussions with people, especially who are not necessarily in a healthcare field, because sometimes I feel like when you're discussing healthcare concerns and healthcare communication concerns, it's very publicized and discussed and understood within health and healthcare circles. But when you talk with people who aren't necessarily directly involved with health or healthcare, it's not something that's on the front of their mind, but it's still something that they're subjected to or something that they come in contact with. So it's just sometimes taking people who are outside of the health sphere and putting them into that conversation brings a new perspective that leads to different solutions. I've been finding as I've been speaking with my friends, is they are not all in healthcare. It's very interesting to find where they're going for their information and how they're kind of taking that information on those lines and incorporating it into their daily life, not necessarily with intentional thought, but because it's what they've encountered.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what you've done in a sort of informal way to a certain extent is exactly what needs to be done at scale, is where do people find the information and how do they integrate it afterwards? And how can we as well give them another option where they can get the information? And then they can decide for themselves, instead of going only to one place, they can go and have different platform and then listen to different point of view. But at least they have a choice, they have option. And this will create as well questioning and wondering and possibly more curiosity. And it's fine. I'm okay. People need to ask questions and people need to get answer. And so if we're not offering them the stream of information that is necessary for them, for their curiosity, then it's our issue.
They
It's
will,
not their issue.
no, they will find it elsewhere, right? The
Yeah,
curiosity
exactly.
die because they don't have the resource that might provide them with the best information. Kind of along the lines of talking about government officials and potentially how they play a role in pandemic preparedness and also communication as well. A lot of global governments, when they follow a democratic structure, have somewhere between, in the highest levels, a 4 to 5 year term. Some overturn afterwards, not necessarily some certainty as to who might be there. Looking forward on a larger scale for long-term pandemic or even people preparedness, communication, healthcare, all those worlds, is there anywhere that you might have turned when you were both president of MSF and on the multiple boards that you've sat, where you're looking beyond that 4 or 5 year term and how to institute long-term communication and pandemic frameworks that kind of pushes past that 4 or 5 year barrier of when a government is set in stone?
Well, I think that at the broader question that you're asking is more is how do we work with government, with cycle of change of power that are every 4 or 5 or 6 years, depending where you are. And then basically, people are setting themselves to make sure that they have short-term deliverable, because if they want to go back on election, they would have something to show off. And that's the issue, because some sort of work is much longer than a cycle of political election. And so it's how do you do? And in some countries, like in the Scandinavian country, there's some issue in terms of education and health that is not going to change with the change of power, because they say the deliverable will take so much longer than a cycle of an election that we have to give it time. I don't know how to face that to a certain extent, but what I do find, I made recently a bit of a little exercise, because someone asked me to go on a TV, a radio show, and to just say, if you were the minister of something, how would you do it? And I picked the minister of migration. But one of the things that we stopped doing, and we used to do in the past, like they did, for example, in the US after 9/11, is they did a bipartisan evaluation afterwards. And this is one of the things we didn't do here, for example, post-COVID, a bipartisan evaluation of how did we fare in times of COVID. Now, putting aside your partisanry and just say, seriously, what did work? What didn't work? What need to be explored more? And if we weren't having those kind of exercise, possibly this cycle would be less of an issue. Then the other way to address that could be then we decide that on that particular topic or particular project, it's going to carry on despite the change of power because it needs to deliver. Will we have the wisdom? Will we have the drive to do something like this is another question. Mm-hmm. But it's not true that every project can deliver with the cycle of political election. It's not true.
So do you think if, for example, the political base was empowered through their own right to say, we are looking for something more long term, if you look less at the people actually in power and more at who put them there, because if we have a democratic society, the beauty is that we have a say in what happens, right? If you empower the base to say, we are looking for that 15-year program and that is what we want out of our electorate, do you think that would be one of the best ways to kind of look at a more long-term, less 4 to 5 year plan?
I'm not sure it would be best or worse. What I'm saying is more that we need to look at it somehow differently. I think that the issue now that we have is the fact that we, since I think it was already started, but the inequities that we're living through, even here in Canada, and the fact that you have so many Canadian families that are having difficulty to pay their rent, to pay for their grocery shopping, to make difficult choices about different things, make it very, very hard to think on the long term. And everybody is looking is what's in it for me because I am not able to pay the basics for my family. And so I cannot blame them that they want something very, very tangible. They mm-hmm. want to make sure that they have a dental program for their children. They want to make sure they have they're paying the rent. Like in Quebec, apparently 1 in 10 children goes with an empty stomach to school. It's
not okay.
And there's something deeply wrong. Mm-hmm. And so when you are facing for people what I call survival choices for your family, it's hard to project yourself on the 10, 15, 20 years. And this is why I'm being cautious about what you propose, because there's some very key stuff that needs to be answered for the general public. We haven't succeeded convincingly yet.
So almost those who have the luxury of looking long term would have too much, arguably, power over what those decisions would be, because looking long term in itself actually is sometimes a luxury. Because if you look long term, it means you kind of already have all your immediate problems solved. Something that if you were to ask people, well, what do you want 15 years out? It would be hitting a certain demographic and missing another demographic.
Yeah, I wonder how you could be very inclusive. Maybe there's a way, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it would be missing the correct kind of, would have a lack of inclusivity. I think one of my other questions for you is, with measles coming back due to, for example, different vaccination rates and the fact that Canada lost its measles elimination status, it has the ability to spread. But then we also had things like COVID where we hadn't had a vaccine for it. We didn't know necessarily in the mass public that it was coming. When you're looking at pandemic spread and what the next pandemic could be, what's the balance between looking at a disease that we have potentially already dealt with, but has the ability to come back due to social perception of different healthcare systems or trust in doctors, and then also looking forward to other diseases that we don't necessarily know about yet that have the ability to come and impact us? Is there going to be a balance between what we know and what we don't know in terms of different diseases for pandemics moving forward?
I think those diseases that we have eliminated in many places with the immunization calendar, the basic immunization calendar, was such a success. It's amazing, and then we know that from 2000 to just before the COVID-19, we basically decrease the number of under 5 deaths for children by half. I think we went from 10 million to 5 million. So that's such an amazing thing. And the Global Alliance for Vaccine International was a big part of it, Gavi, but WHO and all the push for this. And it's absolutely frightening to some extent to see the step back that we have, but not only here in Canada, it's everywhere. Yeah. The Basic Calendar Organization is accusing major step back. We have lost almost a decade of gain in terms of basic immunization. So that's a subject in itself, and that's a subject for now, although it has massive impact across the whole population. But people think it's only something about children, but it's much more than that, because the way it's transmitted, because not everybody got the vaccination, and it will have across age an impact most likely. But then when you talk about a pandemic, which is completely different, because this is something that is unknown, this is something that is scary, this is something that may have even a sort of an existential element to it, mm-hmm. an existential threat elements to it, that is different. And you cannot take the way we behave, for example, with respect to measles, mm-hmm. and do a cut and paste of how we're going to behave for the next big outbreak that would become an epidemic, mm-hmm. and then merge into a regional epidemic and then a pandemic. I don't think so, but I think that because it would depend how it would be portrayed, as much how much of a existential threat it will represent. Because right now we already have different pandemic going on. We have tuberculosis, we have HIV, and then the reality, we don't talk about them, but this is what I call the serial killers. Yeah. They kill, each of them, more or less, you know, close to a million, to 1.5 million, depending which one. So it's on a yearly basis, worldwide. And it doesn't, HIV, neither HIV nor TB is creating any massive reaction. So the new one that we will add to the palmares, will only create reaction depending on how much of a threat it represents. And then people accordingly, will react to it. And it's going to be, I'm not sure how people will react, because there's so much pushback on the threat of pandemic. There's a lot of countries that now are basically abandoning any pandemic preparedness. Mm-hmm. Everybody is turning into what we call hard power preparedness, meaning defense. And the reality is we don't have more money. So basically what we do when you don't have more money is you take the money from one place and you put it to another Excel sheet. Yeah. And that's it. So that's more the way I see it. I think it's going to be difficult. I think that although people understand much more what is a pandemic in generic term, I think it's going to be hard to rally a response and to get people on board initially. And the onus would be on people in public health, people in the sector, mm-hmm. to inform people, to make them want to be part of the response. Because I remember one of the big things we were saying during the Ebola outbreak in 2014, 2016 is epidemic starts and stops in community. Either you get the buy in the community and then you control it faster, or either you don't get the buy in and then it lingers for a long time.
So is there something to be said, and not necessarily fear, because fear, I feel, is never in itself a good emotion to either portray in the media or in communication, but there's almost this correct level of apprehension around any sort of disease that drives the public to a point where they respond to it, but it doesn't push public perception so far over the edge that it turns into mass mania.
Sure. I think there's a way to do it. I think that, and that was one, and you rightly said so, I think that was one of the approach that we had of using fear in a way to create adherence to different public health measure was not a good thing, because fear is never long lasting. People get used to their fear, and at one point they carry on. So we need to go another way of another channel, which is the channel of understanding and having people to take the decision in a real informed way.
Now, along the lines, you said that people are looking now to hard power. They're going to the defensive instead of pandemic preparedness. Could you speak to potentially working with several different countries and how private versus public sector involvement can actually change any sort of medical response?
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you for the question, because I'm a big advocate of the private sector. I am in a measure way. But the thing is, what was interesting, because I learned it the hard way.
Yeah.
When I was in West Africa in 2014, 2016, actually the private sector got really, really involved, because people were not able to move. Initially, we were not able to create traction. And what was interesting is the industry, and I remember it was the rubber industry for Tower Yellowstone in West Africa, which just said, we want to do an Ebola center because we want our staff to be cared for. And we want to learn, and we want to make sure that things... And what is interesting is you just say, well, it's so self-serving and blah, 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 blah.
Certainly.
To a certain extent, but they were welcoming everybody. But of course, there was a part of self-serving, but it was as well for the general public. And so I'm saying that is what I do find interesting about the private sector is how fast they can move.
Yes.
And it's very, very interesting. And if you were to, there's a podcast that's been done. It's in French, but it's called Le Plus Long Printemps. And they talk about how the private sector went and get the PPE in China. They decided to take a plane, but it was not a cargo plane. It was a tourist plane. They brought it to China. They had some deal, but then they realized that they had only 6 hours to pack the plane and then bring it back to Canada. And what did the guy from the private sector do? I say the guy, but it could have been a woman. I don't know. But the person for the private sector said, oh, well, you know, I need to pack my plane within 6 hours. So it's predation, but he went to get see another guy who was putting some sort of stock in the plane. He just say, how much are you paid? And then would you like
to pay more?
And the thing is, I'm not saying this is the right way, but I'm saying there's a different way of finding solution from the private sector, where there is a sense of deliverable much more, and there's a sense of time much more, and things get done. And I'm saying that because recently we had massive project in Quebec where it was under public money, where massive amount of money was wasted because nobody is accountable. Nobody has deliverable per se. It's the fault of the other one. And I think that mindset, I'm not saying that what I just described was perfect, but what I'm saying is there's a mindset about a goal, a deliverable in a timely fashion that I do find sometime that in the public sector we have lost.
Okay. So there's definitely something that some aspects of the private sector that the public sector could learn from in terms of not necessarily accountability, but just getting things done in a timely manner, because health systems, even though we are looking at sometimes a 15, 20 year output, do need to see progress along that line.
Yeah, to a certain extent. So I think the check and balance are much, much stronger. We all know that if you're in the private sector and you don't deliver, the likeliness that you keep your job is not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would you say that in terms of building different health systems? So I know Ontario, for example, in the public sector, they just got one of the largest investments. I believe it was somewhere from $7 to $8 billion to fix the primary care system in Ontario. Do you think that an investment like that along those lines, they had about 5 years, so it was actually a very hard deliverable. Does that sort of structure something that looks a little bit like a private sector deliverable with private sector money in a public health setting? Is that a little bit more of a combination of what private public healthcare could look like?
I'm not sure. I don't know enough of that example, but it's You know, we went through a big era of public-private partnership, the PPP, and there was some success and less success about it. And so we need as well to make some sort of reflection of what we learned from those big projects, from bridges to different sort of road and all that. But or hospital as well has been done through that kind of PPP deal. So and I cannot answer specifically on this one.
Mm-hmm. But so kind of looking more along the lines of how private sector could interact with the public sector would be somewhere where we could go. Because I know Canada definitely has some private healthcare, but there's also a lot of public healthcare. Do you think one of the solutions to Canada's kind of public healthcare crisis would be to involve the private sector a little bit more in areas where they can be involved to still create equitable healthcare?
Yeah, it's so difficult to, and I'm not a healthcare system of the of high income country, but this thing is how can we safeguard access to medicine, access to care, and create a common public good for all in a time where resources are not the same, and the needs are not the same. I think that that's how we have to look at it. But I don't want. Anyway, I still believe in Canada Act and the access to care for everybody. Mm-hmm. I still believe that we need to strive for that, to thrive for that, preserve as much of a common public good. But that being said, after that, there's going to be fringes of things could be done in partnership. The reality is I think that healthcare costs more, period. With an aging population like we are, it will not decrease. If we don't get, if you still have the inverted pyramid of age like we have, it will only cost more.
So healthcare along the next 15 to 20 years will progressively only get more expensive.
The way it works is as you grow older, you have a little bit more issue.
Yeah, you need more doctors. You get a larger.
So, yeah.
I think one of the last questions that I have for you today is kind of building off both the public-private healthcare sector and a lot of the work that you've done at MSF. So the role of NGOs is changing. I know at least personally through some of my global health classes, especially with the US, and even though the World Health Organization is not necessarily an NGO by definition, it's still a collective of countries. How do you think this changing role of NGOs and, for example, intermediaries like the World Health Organization or different organizations like MSF is going to change over the next 10 years on the health landscape, especially when it comes to working with different countries in this kind of era of growing political tension?
I think it's going to be a difficult sequence for non-governmental organization. I think that MSF, Doctors Without Borders, is a bit in a different landscape in the sense that more than 95% of their donation is from the private sector. These private donors is you and I and my uncle and my father who gives money. And so they have much more, I would say, flexibility and they didn't have such a huge budget cut as some other organization who were under USAID funds or under ODA funds that has been decreased almost everywhere in the OECD country. So I think that there would be, I'm not sure that all the NGO will pull through that sequence. I think there's going to be a sort of a Darwinist effect to that.
Yeah.
And then after that is everybody are looking into how you're going to diversify the funds. And so a lot of people who were having estate donation would go to private donors. And then this is where things might get very, because you might change one thing for another thing that is not necessarily better. Let's say you have those big philanthropists who wants to control the whole global health landscape and have a view on things that is very peculiar, then all of a sudden
it's a different global health landscape.
it's a different level of answer with a priority that is from only one person. Mm-hmm. And on the long run, I'm not sure that we're going to need to be careful around that, because that's the danger, that you would have only 3, 4, 5 philanthropists who would be running the show and then financing all those little NGOs. And there would be only 4 or 5 priorities because they would be coming from those 4 or 5. And it's untrue. That it's not because you're a billionaire that you don't have blind spots.
Yeah. And unfortunately, with today's net wealth of some individuals, or with net wealth kind of growing, it's definitely a possible reality where you really do have 4 or 5 people sitting at the table calling the shots, and that's it. Here's hoping the solution comes about to that, and that is not how the global health landscape looks in 15 to 20 years. But thank you so much for joining us today. It was absolutely lovely to speak with you. I know personally I got a lot of really great insight out of this conversation, and it was amazing to kind of pick your brain for all the information that you had to share with us today.
Thank you very much.